This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
It's very clear that it is a function of corporate greed, and that, yes, we are the people who are creating the art. Like, they're the ones who are finding the platforms, and they're distributing it, and they're selling it, but they don't have a product without the writer.
Hollywood writers are on strike.
We're in the process of creating the norms of a digital society, and that it was up to us to say, what should those rules look like? This shouldn't be a handful of VCs in Silicon Valley. It shouldn't be this, you know, very limited set of individuals getting to define these rules.
Artificial intelligence may threaten the future of artists and writers.
This is a deadly blockade. This isn't just a blockade that makes life harder on the Cuban people. No, this is a blockade that results in death and suffering for the Cuban people.
The International People's Assembly's May Day Brigade returns from Cuba, and they call for an end to the U.S. genocidal blockade of the socialist island.
And now to move to other issues of importance, including ensuring that Eritrean troops are completely removed.
The U.S. uses soft power to try to control post-war Ethiopia. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. On May 2nd, 11,500 members of the Writers Guild of America went on strike. Since talks with Hollywood studios began on March 20th, the two sides have failed to reach an accord on a new three-year film and TV writers' contract to replace one that expired on May 1st. KPFK's Janine Roan interviewed comedy writers Heather Huntington and Danielle Evenson, who were on the picket line.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Danielle Evenson. And I'm Heather Huntington.
Yep.
Very nice. And we've been writing partners for about 7 years.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we worked on everything from children's TV to adult comedies to TV movies. And I started in the business really as a PA and working for the Guild covered show, The New Adventures of Old Christine. Yep. Heather came up via entertainment journalism.
I did. And when we got together a few years ago, we started writing together. And then at the beginning of the pandemic, we sold a series to Disney, which is how I actually got my Guild card.
Exactly. So we're excited to participate in what's happening now.
Yeah, this is Danielle's second strike and my first.
The past couple of years, the studios are investing like $19 billion this year, and we'll be right for streaming. It's up to $5 billion. That's up from $5 billion from 2019.
Yeah.
So that's a huge, dramatic investment.
Right.
And you know, it is. We feel like it is time for us, who we've created, not us personally, 4,000.
And us.
Yeah. We're very busy.
All of us in the Guild.
Exactly. The entire Guild, 4,000 episodes of scripted programming each year to participate in those profits.
Yes. And one of the things, I mean, first of all, to back up what Danielle said, you know, Adam Conover, who is one of the Guild reps, has been, and he has the show Adam Ruins Everything. And so, not surprisingly, because this is really his ballywick, he's doing a very good job explaining a lot of the points
Absolutely.
Of the strike and what's going on. And one of the things he said, and I continually forget the exact number, but basically, I mean, some of the things he's like quoted in an article saying that the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery was paid $250 million last year.
And you mean made $250 million last year?
Yes.
Or in streaming?
No, he was paid. That's about the same level as what 10,000 writers are asking him to pay all of us collectively. Basically, it's like a tiny portion of their like the CEO's bonuses of some mm-hmm. of the streaming companies would basically cover all of our negotiation points if they didn't even negotiate at all. So it's very clear that it is a function of corporate greed, and that, yes, we are the people who are creating the art. Like, they're the ones who are finding the platforms, and they're distributing it, and they're selling it, but they don't have a product without the writers.
Exactly.
And to sort of back up what Heather was saying, you know, if we got everything we asked for, it would cost the studios less than 2% of their profits.
Right.
Which is incredibly small. And they're just absolutely stonewalling and refusing to bargain at all on so many of the bargaining points. Mm-hmm. They, you know, on several of them, they gave really insulting offers. But mm-hmm. on several of them, they fully just refused to bargain at all, which is pretty rough. Including one thing that's particularly important for us as a team. So the health and pension for writing teams was one of the negotiation points that they just fully refused to even discuss.
Exactly. So, you know, it's affecting us as both as a team, as individuals.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing that I was just, you know, when I was looking over some of the bargaining points, the thing that's actually the new thing that I realized is that, you know, a lot of this has to do with streaming, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy and variety writers mm-hmm. have no minimums,
mm-hmm.
No required minimums when their content is made for streaming, which is, I mean, that says, I feel like in a way, like that says
everything.
Everything, mm-hmm. because a lot of what's happening when things branched out to streaming, and again with the creation of mini rooms, is, it seems to me, and Danielle, correct me if I'm wrong, because Danielle's really great at this stuff, is that
you are very sweet.
I am.
It is true.
Is that the studios have found a loophole to wiggle out of agreements they have previously made. You know, we had in previous strikes.
Mm-hmm.
Previous writers have gone before us to fight for fair pay,
absolutely,
minimums,
and the studios pension,
and that the studios have agreed to. And I mean, so the studios have agreed to pay a certain amount mm-hmm. to writers,
mm-hmm.
and then there became this new outlet, streaming services, that was not technically covered by that agreement, and so the studios found a way to dramatically reduce the pay that they had already agreed to. And that's, you know, part of the reason why it's so unfair. And one of the ways is, you know, mm-hmm. no minimums for comedy and variety content on streaming. Another way is mini rooms, which mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk about. And the reason why the mini rooms are such a big deal is that one of the things that happens with a mini room is that they hire a bunch of writers. They get them to do the same amount of work for less pay. Those writers are getting dramatically less than their usual quotes because, again, the studios don't have to pay their minimum because mini rooms aren't covered and under the bargaining agreement the way other things are. And
I think what you're saying is that the mini rooms allow them to hire a small amount of writers.
Yep.
Before a show is greenlit.
Yes. The pre-greenlight room.
Exactly.
They get all the same amount of work. They pay them less.
Then they are there for a less amount of time.
Yes.
Because they aren't there for production.
Yeah. They get rid of all those writers. Mm-hmm. Then the showrunners have the burden of the rest of the work. But what happens if you are a writer in a mini room is that you wind up not making enough money, first of all, just to, like, pay your rent. But also, you'll wind up not making enough for your pension or your health. So that's another reason why that's a really important point. That's why these protections are in place.
Yeah, it's really destroying the middle class of writers.
Exactly.
And I think the great thing is that we have every major Hollywood union and community leaders across LA behind us.
Right. We were at the Shrine Auditorium at the big meeting on Tuesday night, and it was extremely inspiring, and all the unions were there absolutely backing us up. It is unquestionably a unified front with all the unions.
We just heard from Writers Guild of America West members Heather Huntington and Danielle Evenson speaking to KPFK's Janine Roan. Artificial intelligence threatens the future of artists and writers. Neil Turkovitz spoke at a forum held by Concept Art Association.
So I've been involved in looking at the relationship of technology to the arts, But always, even when I had a specific function representing the music industry, my take on it was always that we were involved in the creation of rules and norms for an emerging digital society. And almost all of those, kind of starting from the mid-1990s, tended to view individual creations, individual creators, and copyright as an impediment to innovation. So that almost all of the movement out of Silicon Valley, out of the VCs in Silicon Valley, were looking at how do we remove the irritants of copyright from the things that we wanted to do. So there's been sort of a constant 25 or 30 year evolution of technology looking to get inputs for as cheap as possible, and the cheapest way of possible is simply taking. And to roll those into ideas, kind of these broad social ideas, that somehow what we were doing was democratizing either the creation or access to cultural materials. So we saw that in lots of different areas. We saw it in music, we saw it in film, but we've seen it just more broadly, almost as a political movement, the democratization of democracy. And when I first came across sort of what was happening in the AI arena, probably that was in around 2017, 2018, well before generative AI was part of the picture, it dawned on me that this was simply the newest iteration of something that had been in place for a long time. The acquisition of content to drive business models at the lowest possible price, always being characterized as sort of progress and innovation in achieving efficiency and democratization. So every part of my body recoiled against this idea that now we were taking what had been sort of limited instances and applying it to the entire corpus of the world's global cultural production. All of it, someone just earlier talked about, grist for the mill for the development of AI. So I immediately started to engage. And at that point, unfortunately, I didn't really have any relationships with artists who were being directly affected. I looked at it from a broad theoretical, philosophical orientation. Again, moved by this idea that we're in the process of creating the norms of a digital society, and that it was up to us to say, what should those rules look like? This shouldn't be a handful of VCs in Silicon Valley. This shouldn't be this, you know, very limited set of individuals getting to define these rules. And when I say digital society, in a sense, we could drop the digital, because the digital society is society. We've lost all of the illusory distinctions that once existed between digital and the real world. They're all part of the same thing. So yeah, so I started engaging at that and looking at the frivolity of treating this very broad misappropriation as part of fair use. I mean, fair use by its terms is supposed to be in limited circumstances. And here we were talking about a misappropriation in the broadest circumstances. So it appealed to me immediately, both in terms of my desire to fuel artists, to sustain the livelihood of artists, and not from the perspective of that I thought we owed it to artists. I think we owe it to society, to everyone who cares about the arts, to what the arts contribute to the well-being of all of us who aren't artists.
That was Neil Turkowitz on artificial intelligence threatening the future of artists and writers.
Remote beats on the chat.
Hey, we going on strike. We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike.
For real.
Till they get this right.
Come on.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
All day.
We going on strike.
All night.
Till they get this right.
Look. Come on.
We going on strike, so you better listen. We ain't about to keep working under these conditions.
Facts.
Working in a hot plant with no air
conditioning.
And they got the nerve to tell us that this fair conditions.
Yeah, right.
They don't work they off, they gon' get fired.
Facts.
Temps working like slaves and don't get hired.
Come on.
The supervisor don't care if they get tired. make sure them sales get higher. The union gotta stay together, do this for each other. Do this one for all my sisters, do this for our brothers. Cause they tryna treat us wrong, but they say they love us. We need a change right now, we ain't going further.
Yes.
We going on strike.
Strike.
We going on strike.
For real.
We going on strike.
Tonight.
Till they get this right.
That was GMAT Cash on strike. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. 3,000 Oakland teachers who are members of the Oakland Education Association have gone on strike for wage increases and also for more counselors and nurses and better conditions for students in the schools. Pacifica was there covering the opening date of the strike on May 4th, 2023.
I'm a special education social worker with Oakland Unified. What we're doing is we're trying to get a separate salary schedule because we're one of the lowest paid social work groups in the entire Bay Area. So we want to have a separate salary schedule, be able to keep our social workers, and have the district stop contracting to get mental health when people just have so much turnover and instead keep all the social workers to support the kids. We only have 6 general social workers, 35 special ed social workers, and about 12 newcomer social workers. But we have way more kids than that. And the ratios are supposed to be 250 to 1. And for high needs, 50 to 1. So.
And the conditions of these kids with the stress, the COVID, housing problems,
trauma, shootings, all the things that have
happened. It's a nightmare.
Yes, and there's not, we get referrals every single week to try to get students' mental health, and we can't even keep up with the referrals because there's so many kids, so many families, so many kids that need individual counseling. They need support. They need case management to get housing, to get their special education needs met, to get just even their basic needs, getting to and from school, being able to attend. All of those things are so, so important. And we can't do that if we're paying our social workers so little money.
And also they're closing down some of the schools. And how would that affect the children in these schools?
I mean, it's going to majorly affect them. They're going to have to go to other schools. They're going to be overcrowding. There's going to be less support and less time for the kids. On top of that, they're looking at closing SDC classrooms, other special day classes, mental health classrooms, and all of those things are a legal right written into the kids' IEPs. So if they are not getting the support that they deserve and are given by law, they're not going to be able to have the mental health support or be able to access their education in the same way. And those teachers will get kicked out of their programs and have nowhere to go.
Yeah, the baseline for our students in Oakland is to be traumatized. We have kids that are facing multifaceted and interrelated adverse forces all of the time. Now we have COVID, the ripple effect from that is alive and well. We have students that we have not seen come back to school since we went to the pandemic and learned from home. So it's really a crisis moment.
My name is Erica Richardson, and the issues that are going on, why we're here today is we are protesting. We're on strike. We already sent a nice little package of things that we need in order to function better at our job. All of those things are listed on our website as well, OEA. And the main thing for me is nurses in the schools for the kids, the proper distribution of the funds that we get. From being a public school, we do get funds, and they use those funds for themselves. Teachers are paid poorly. A lot of us can't even afford to even live here. A lot of teachers have moved out of Oakland who would love to live here, but they can't afford it, and the salary just isn't enough. So those are two of the main things for me, but there's many, many, many more. I think the reason why you can't get black teachers in the public schools is because of money and the treatment. The treatment that they treat black teachers with in schools is we're kind of treated in a way as if we're not as educated as other educators, and they also kind of treat us in a hostile way as if we are creating hostile environments when we're not. We just communicate.
Talking about black history.
Right. Like talking about black history, telling the real history of things and the truth from our perspective as a non-white person, and they don't want that. They just want white stories and white voices, and black teachers, we don't agree to that, and we don't adhere to that. Most of them don't. We always add black history into our curriculum, Latin history into our curriculum, Native history into our curriculum, and they don't want that.
You have some newly elected board members, black, Mike Hutchinson. What's happening with the school board?
I don't know, but what I feel is that the school board has drank the Kool-Aid. They have. It doesn't matter what color they are at this point. They've drank the Kool-Aid, they've signed with the man, and they are just worried about themselves and what they can get. I watched most of them when we were at the rallies. Some of them were there wearing their suits. They have their fancy cars, and some of these teachers can barely eat.
My name is Jennifer Brohart, and I'm speaking as an individual that we have a school board that couldn't deliver, in my opinion. Does that work? But it's really hard facing all my colleagues out here who I've worked with over the years and knowing that you guys elected us and we still can't deliver. But I want you to know that the three of us individually are working hard to get this contract done. And we'll be on the picket lines with you guys in the mornings. We were there today, we'll be there tomorrow.
My name is Francisco Gaxiola, and I am the music teacher at Fremont High School in East Oakland. We're here today because our school district refuses to negotiate in good faith, and we are the lowest paid teachers in all of Alameda County. All we want is a median pay for all the teachers and also safer schools, and the district is not negotiating in good faith with us.
And what does that mean for low salaries as far as your school and other schools in Oakland?
With the low salary, teachers are leaving. 25% of teachers leave Oakland every year to go to other districts because neighboring districts pay a lot better and take care of their teachers and students, and our district is not doing that.
Why is that?
I have no idea, but the members of the board and other high-ranking managers at the district are making upwards of $200,000 and $300,000 a year, and don't get, they don't have to deal with the stuff that we're dealing in the front lines in the classroom. They don't have to deal with any of that. They don't deal with students on a daily basis. They just sit in their office and collect these huge paychecks.
And you're talking about a 25% turnover every year. I mean, how does that affect education for the kids?
There is no continuity. You know, teachers, that, especially like at the high school level, I could stay at Fremont for many years and have the relationship with students throughout their entire high school career. But if our teachers are leaving, then our students don't have that continuity. They don't have the same benefits of even in Alameda County.
My name is Faye Wong, and I'm a grandparent of my granddaughter there who goes to Piedmont Elementary, and my son's a teacher, and both my husband and I, we really feel that it's very important to support the teachers. They have been underpaid. They need a lot more support in the classroom. You know, they need the social workers and others, staff that will give them more support. They work way too hard.
So my name is Mystic. So I am not only an artist, I am a community educator, and I'm also a substitute teacher. What I know, I've been facilitating arts for almost 30 years. The power of music in what I call beautiful resistance is that it feeds the soul, it builds community, it reminds us that we must have joy within, you know, all the work that we're doing to fight for.
You gotta have fun.
Yeah, we gotta have fun. What's that? I'll paraphrase it. I don't want to be in your revolution if I can't dance. For me personally, I don't want to be in your revolution if we can't sing, and we can't build solidarity. And what we know about music is going back thousands and thousands and thousands of years, is that music is a language. Even when it doesn't have a verbal component, if it's the drumming and the griots, this is all about how we communicate with community, build community, document our histories, and also imagine the power of words and music to imagine how we want to shift the paradigm from one that is unjust to one that is just and more equitable. It's a spirit of people. It is. And I've had the privilege of studying all over the world and facilitating with children in different places in the world. And music, art, always brings folks together. I started as an MC when I was 16 years old, and I still continue to do it, but it is the voice of who we are, particularly in communities that are economically under-resourced and economically vulnerable, where we don't have art programs in schools, where we don't have the support structures, that this is how we deal with our trauma. This is how we tell our stories. This is how we document who we are and say, I'm here too, right? Like, hear me. Hear me and hear what I need to thrive.
Take our shine, we will walk the picket line. Take our shine, we will walk the picket line. Take our shine, we will walk the picket line.
Those were voices of Oakland Education Association strikers and supporters in Oakland, California.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. Working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
John Lennon, working class hero. Retired UAW Local 879 President Rob McKenzie has been looking at the role of the CIA and AFL-CIO in 1990 when 200 thugs attacked the Ford assembly plant in Mexico City. He discovered the attack was organized and financed by the U.S. government and wrote the book El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico. He spoke at a panel held by the Labor Education Project of AFL-CIO International Operations.
In January 8, 1990, about 300 armed thugs, which I'll call golpeadores, entered the Ford assembly plant just north of Mexico City. So they were there when the workers reported for work in the morning. They began intimidating them, threatening them. The workers, many of them were prepared for this, and fought back and started to drive the golpeadores out. They opened fire, shooting nine, and one of them died. In response to that, the workers occupied the plant and they held it for 15 days until on January 22nd, they were driven out by 2,000 police. And once that happened, they went on strike. They set up an encampment in front of the plant and continued the strike. After a few weeks, Ford got the government to ditch the contract. Ford and the CTM sent out letters to all the workers telling them if they did not report for work, they would be fired. And people started slowly trickling back. They didn't get very many back, and the ones that got back weren't doing much work. At the end of March of 1990, the Ford CFO came in to Mexico City from Detroit, and they signed an agreement with the local union, a CTM local union, ending the strike. Now, they didn't get much. They didn't get the demands of the occupation. They didn't get any agreement to hire everybody back, but they were really in a weak position. So the strike continued, really. In April, the workers who had not received a notice to return to work, about 600 of them, tried to physically re-enter the building, and they were blocked by 1,500 police. In June, they did a nude-in. The ones who hadn't been rehired went to the Department of Mediation and Conciliation office and took off their clothes, symbolically making the statement they were totally without protection from the CTM. And if you look at the, I got the embassy cables about this. Ford was not able to get production up and running, even up to June. And they finally settled with these 600 people they fired and gave them severance pay. And at that point, the next big hope for this movement was to switch labor confederations from the government-affiliated CTM to another approved labor federation. And at that point, they really began reaching out internationally to try to get support. And so that's when my local really got deeply involved. The October, there was a Minnesota State AFL-CIO convention, and we were able to get Briones to speak at that. So Rod Hayworth, who's on here, was our delegate at that. So he spoke there. And I also, I want to read what he said at that meeting. He's quoted in the labor press as what he said at that AFL-CIO convention. And this is concerning the free trade agreement. October 1991, Raul Escobar Briones came to Minnesota and addressed the Minnesota State AFL-CIO convention. He declared that Mexican authorities and government-influenced unions were eager to collaborate with foreign corporations and support the agreement, proposed NAFTA is what we're talking about there, to demonstrate that Mexico will supply cheap and cooperative labor. Escobar urged delegates to work in solidarity with Mexican and Canadian workers because we're all affected by the free trade agreement, he said. He said Mexican workers have little hope for change without legal reforms in Mexico, without international coordination by unions to defend labor gains in the face of the global marketplace. Well, I think time has proven what he said was exactly right. And this was 3 years before NAFTA went into effect. There have been some significant legal changes in Mexico, and we have the rise of the independent unions down there. But something that still needs more work is this international labor coordination and international worker solidarity and part of American workers and American unions. That film really touched on a lot of what was going on there. And I thought really for the time it was made, really did a good job. Part of it was about the election between the two labor federations, the CTM, and the other was CORE, or Confederation of Revolutionary Workers. When the trouble started, the members at the CTM local at Cuautitlan voted to leave the CTM and join CORE. So the government organized an election. That was the election that took place in June. And we sent two people down as observers. Massively fraudulent election. I have an embassy cable that John Negroponte, who was the ambassador at the time, sent, which was really a whitewash of that election. So, but after that defeat, as far as we could tell, the struggle really started fading back. They had really taken on some powerful forces, the government union, Ford, and I'm quite certain the CIA was behind the attack on the plant. And that's really what a lot of the book is about. Now, in 1996, I was at a meeting at the Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras on the borders in Matamoros and Brownsville. And at the conclusion of that meeting, a staff person for the newly elected president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, came up to me and told me that they believed that AFELD had been involved, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, had been involved in the events at Ford Cuautitlan. And I just kind of vaguely thought that was related to the CIA, and he said, yes, it was. Over the years, I heard from another very good source that AFELD had been involved in the events there. And when I retired in 2016, I determined that I was going to research this and find out what happened in that. Because from my view of that, there was a golden opportunity to build solidarity with the Mexican workers. I mean, you know, people my age lived through a massive deindustrialization and deunionization of the country as work transferred to Mexico. And the only thing that could have made any difference in that was to help the Mexicans raise their wages and benefits. And we missed an opportunity there. So that was really my interest in this. So I found out that the AFL-CIO had control over the AFLD archives. And I knew two people who were working on the staff of the National AFL-CIO who I knew were sympathetic to my views on this. And they did start out helping me. They organized a meeting with the International Affairs Director, Kathy Feingold, about what was the procedure I should follow to gain access to the archives. And they told me what I needed to do. And so I wrote her a letter and wrote one to the George Meany Memorial Archives at the University of Maryland, which is where those archives are at. I got an email back from Kathy Feingold saying they were working with the University of Maryland and she would get back to me and thank you for my interest. Last thing I ever heard from anybody in the National AFL-CIO. My friend, after a few weeks of nobody responding and nothing happening, I said, I think something's wrong here. Is this a big controversy or what am I getting into here? And my friend said, oh no, this is not controversial. Everybody knows here the CIA was involved with labor. That was the last email I ever got from him and never got another email about anything. But anyway, he had told me, well, you just have to be patient. So I'll be patient. I can do that. I had heard the UAW had archives and files on this from a very good source. And I had just retired from the UAW. So I really believed that that would be much easier to get access to those files. So I started out sending an email to Dennis Williams, who he was the president. I knew him. He had hired me for the international staff in 2006. Didn't get a response from him. Another email, no response. So not that unusual for Dennis Williams. So I drove to Illinois and met with the Region 4 director and told him what I was doing and that I wanted to get the UAW's files on what happened there at Fort Cortitlan. He said he was going to be seeing Dennis in a few weeks and he would talk to him and get back to me. And I worked for that guy for 5 years, and that was the only time he ever told me he would get back to me, and he never did. So I said, okay, well, I know how this is going to go now. So I wrote a letter to Williams claiming I had a right under the UAW Constitution to see those files and minutes from the International Executive Board concerning this. No answer. So, under the UAW Constitution, you wait 30 days, nothing happens, you can appeal it to the next level. So I appealed it through three levels, over about 6 months. Nobody ever answered one certified letter I sent him on this. And finally, I got to the UAW Public Review Board, the Ethics Committee of the UAW. And they said, well, we're an appellate body, but if nobody has had a hearing on this, we will have a hearing. And they notified the president's office of that. So 2 days later, I did get contacted by somebody I knew at the president's office. And he really didn't know what was going on. Nobody gave him any background about this. And he did really make an effort to help me track down these files. And he got somebody's laptop and started searching through it. At that point, somebody contacted me and told me where the files were. They were at the Reuther Library at Wayne State University and two nodes, one's the Bieber node and the other in the International Affairs Department node. So I got an index for the Reuther Library and did a search for Mexico. The International Affairs Department files for those years are closed for the UAW, as they are for the AFL-CIO. But I did find the Bieber node, and I found 12 different files where I thought there might be interesting information or relevant information about this. And one of the files was called the American Institute for Free Labor Development. So I had a friend in Detroit who got a master's degree at Wayne State go look through these files, so I didn't have to make the trip. And he took photographs of them. He found some great stuff. The only real problem was the file called American Institute for Free Labor Development had nothing in it concerning American Institute for Free Labor Development. Had information from AFL-CIO speeches and Alaskan oil exports, which were the two folders next to it. So it was obvious to me someone had taken all the AFL material out and then replaced it with the files next to it, so that when they turned the box back, it wouldn't be empty. So I contacted the library director and tried to get them to figure out what had happened here. And he finally told me that, well, this had just been a mistake. There had never been an American Institute for Free Labor Development file. It was just a mistake by their PhD archivists when they were organizing this stuff. Well, I don't think anybody believed that. I certainly didn't believe that. And I later found documents that proved Owen Bieber was on the board of directors of the American Institute for free labor development. So at a bare minimum, he would have got newsletters, financial reports, and maybe much more. Who knows? That's what I believe that was in that file. But when that disappeared, I guess I wasn't that surprised because I knew there were a lot of people who didn't want that material found. What surprised me was how willing the archives were to cover that up. They changed the name within a few days to AFL-CIO Speeches and Alaskan Oil Exports. Scratch it, took off the name American Institute for Free Labor Development and put a new name on it.
That was retired UAW Local 879 President Rob McKenzie talking about his book, El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico. That was music by Los Folcloristas. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. Despite the blockade of Cuba by the U.S., more than 150 American youth went to Cuba to commemorate May Day. Ali Abdul Qader, an activist and journalist with Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, was part of the delegation. He spoke with Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke.
So I recently had the opportunity to travel to Cuba as a part of the International People's Assembly's May Day Brigade. It was a collection of over 150 young leaders from across the United States who are actively organizing in their communities and went there to observe the May Day celebrations that happen every year in Cuba and to learn from the Cuban Revolution, to learn how Cuban society is organized, and to commit to ending the blockade.
What are some of the highlights of what you learned or experienced while there?
So I was there for 10 days. And there were a lot of setbacks during our trip. So initially, before we got to Cuba, we received news that fuel shipments to the island had been canceled due to U.S. pressure on insurance companies to prevent the insuring of the oil, the actual ships that were shipping the oil. So the island was going to have to do with about half of the fuel consumption that they were used to. So that presented a lot of difficulties, not only to us, but of course to the people of the island and to the May Day celebrations. But one thing that I was always struck by during my trip was the tenacity and the resistance of the Cuban people. You know, they always had their chin up. They never gave up, no matter the adverse conditions, no matter what struck them. It was remarkable. So initially, the plan was to be there for the normal May Day celebration, which is a large march in Havana. But the government made the difficult decision at first to split up the march into several sort of decentralized neighborhood marches so that people could walk to a march near them. But unfortunately, while I was in Cuba, a storm hit the island a day before May Day. And knocked out electricity in about half of Havana and destroyed a lot of the physical preparations for May Day. So unfortunately, the government had to make the very difficult decision to delay the May Day celebrations until after our trip ended, which was on May 5th yesterday. So that was one of the things that I was struck most by is no matter what the conditions were, the Cuban people continue to resist. They continue to not only resist to, but to be an example of how a society could be organized in a more humane manner. You know, even though they lack resources because of the blockade, right? They're not able to trade with other countries because the U.S. doesn't want them to be able to trade with other countries, right? The U.S. Applies sanctions to stop them not only from trading with American companies and American entities, but also internationally with any product that has at least 10% of it made in the U.S. or any sale that's being made in U.S. dollars. The U.S. Treasury will block that trade between Cuba and a foreign entity. Any ship that docks in Cuba will not be able to dock in the U.S. for 180 days afterwards. Those are some of the coercive economic measures in the blockade that we talk about. Another thing that the U.S. is doing against Cuba is they've labeled them a state sponsor of terrorism. So this has severely limited the financial transactions that they're able to do across the world, because banks, if they deal with Cuba or Cuban entities, they could be fined, they could be subject to secondary sanctions from the U.S. Treasury. It's made life for the Cuban people very difficult. It's made Cuban industry suffer a lot. So when this measure was implemented by Trump in January 2021, the Cuban medical industry output reduced by 60% over the next year. You know, this is one of the biggest industries in Cuba, the medical industry. Not only do the Cuban people rely on it, because again, it's hard for them to trade, but also it's one of the ways that Cuba is able to bring in income, bring in a hard currency by trading this to be able to trade for other resources. So when this happened, obviously the result is that people die from this. This is a deadly blockade. This isn't just a blockade that makes life harder on the Cuban people. No, this is a blockade that results in death and suffering for the Cuban people. But what I witnessed and what we witnessed on the island was that people were extremely resilient. They were creative in how they resisted the blockade, and that truly, if this island was not subject to these economic coercive measures, it would be one of the most futuristic countries, I think, in the world today. Our presence on the island as people in the U.S. who are struggling for social justice, as people in the U.S. who are socialists, as people in the U.S. who oppose the blockade, that really boosted morale, you know, and everyone that we talked to, knowing that there were people in the U.S. who understood what the U.S. was doing to Cuba, supported the Cuban people, opposed the blockade, were in Cuba because they opposed the blockade, that really boosted morale very significantly with everyone we talked to. And it was certainly another one of our goals of our brigade was to strengthen the resolve of the Cuban people themselves. But I would be lying if I said it wasn't a very difficult time for the Cuban people. I do think that they have plans to get out of the sort of rut that they are in right now. But ultimately, what is needed is we need to end this genocidal blockade on the Cuban people.
Were there any interrogations or any difficulties that you care to share?
I personally did not have any trouble going in or actually even coming out. I was very lucky in that regard, because several of my fellow Brigadistas, when they traveled back into the country, were stopped by Customs and Border Patrol in the airports in Miami. And they were held for hours for questioning. They were subject to political interrogation, kind of trying to find out why they were in Cuba, who did they meet, all these questions. They had their phones seized. Several people had their phones indefinitely seized and were held for up to 2 hours in secondary detention in the airport. At this point, everyone has been released, but the people who had their phones seized are still without their phones. To be clear, there is nothing illegal about what we did in Cuba. We totally have the right to be in Cuba, to exchange with the Cuban people, exchange with the Cuban youth, to learn from Cuba and to support the Cuban people. This is an intimidation tactic by the American government to try to prevent people from exercising their right to go to Cuba. Because if Americans were actually able to go to Cuba and see how it is, that would be the first step in demolishing the propaganda that the U.S. has built around Cuba, that, oh, it's a dictatorship, that people are suffering because of political repression, that people hate it there. That's not the case.
That was Ali Abdelkader, an activist and co-host of The Ruthless Truth on Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, speaking with Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke.
Aprendimos a quererte desde la histórica altura, donde el sol de tu bravura le puso cerco a la muerte.
Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia.
That was Hasta Siempre, Comandante, a song composed in 1965 by Cuban composer Carlos Puebla. The Ethiopian Civil War ended in November 2022 with the victory of the Ethiopian National Defense Force over the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. The United States, however, which backed the TPLF in the war, continues to try to control the war's outcome with various forms of soft power. Pacifica's Anne Garrison has more.
The U.S. continues to back the TPLF in the aftermath of the Ethiopian Civil War by exerting soft power. Antony Blinken has implicitly threatened criminal responsibility and the possibility of international prosecution, particularly for the Amhara Special Forces and irregular Fano militia, accusing them of ethnic cleansing in a northern Ethiopian region claimed by both Amhara and Tigrayans. He has also continued to demand the removal of Eritrean forces from northern Ethiopia, although it's not clear that there are any there. Ethiopia would be well within its rights to welcome them. This is in keeping with the long-standing U.S. policy of attempting to drive a wedge between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa Mike Hammer recently returned from a trip to Ethiopia, after which he expressed the U.S. position at the United States Institute for Peace, a Washington-based organization created by Ronald Reagan and funded by Congress.
Since taking this job last July, the singular focus was to try to bring peace to northern Ethiopia, the world's then worst and most horrific conflict, which didn't really make a lot of headlines, and particularly not since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but one which cost hundreds of thousands of lives and was just a conflict that we were extremely concerned about. And through the work that we did with the African Union, we, the United States, participated as an observer in the African Union-led talks in Pretoria of October and November of last year, which produced the cessation of hostilities agreement on November 2nd. And we're very proud to have supported that effort along with others. And now we've seen a silencing of the guns, efforts to have humanitarian assistance delivery to northern Ethiopia, to the affected regions of Tigray, Afar, and Amhara, to meet the needs of the people, restoration of services, and now to move to other issues of importance, including ensuring that Eritrean troops are completely removed from the region, and that you deal with other Amhara special forces and Fano groups that are active in the area.
That was U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Mike Hammer, speaking at the United States Institute for Peace and asserting that peace in northern Ethiopia is the business of the United States. He affected a neutral tone, but took the side of the TPLF by saying that the U.S. must, quote, move to other issues of importance, including ensuring that Eritrean troops are completely removed from the region, and that you deal with Amhara Special Forces and Fano groups that are active in the area. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalism-race-democracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.